Ephemeral Permanences, a podcast series by Radio Alta Camera. Broadcast from CAM, Gulbenkian Modern Art Centre, within a public-facing artistic residency focused on ecological materials, their relationship with architectural projects, and a new attitude toward construction. In each episode, architects, designers, researchers, and curators come together to rethink the act of building, biomaterials, cycles, processes, time. Building with what changes, designing with what lives, planning its death. Matter, transformation, and possible futures.
Good morning, everybody. Today, we welcome Giulia Bellinetti, an Italian researcher working at the intersection of contemporary art, ecology, and institutional transformation. Currently, she is the coordinator of the Natural Research Department and the Future Materials Lab at the Jan van Eyck Academy in Maastricht. Giulia's work critically engaged with one of the most urgent questions of our times: how cultural institutions respond to the ecological crisis. Rather than a simple observing, she explores how institutions themselves can reimagine, rethink how art is produced, circulated, and situated within the broader environmental systems. Along this, she has a PhD on Amsterdam School of Cultural Analysis, where she investigates the evolving role of art institutions in addressing environmental challenges. This conversation takes place within a framework of the Ephemeral Permanence Residence at CAM, of Radio Alta Camera, Centro di Arte Moderna Gulbenkian, where we have been exploring materials practices, ecological cycles, and new relationships between architecture, nature, and culture. Hello, Giulia. Welcome to this podcast, and thank you very much for accepting this challenging. I start immediately with the first question that for us as architects, it's very, very important. As you know, the industry, construction industry, is very resistant. More than resilient, it's very resistant to changes. And especially in this question of materialization, there is a complex thing about certification and fear, let's say. There is a very slow adopt of new materials. So it's very, very difficult to see, for example, in buildings from the 30s, from the 20s, and the changes that it's happening actually in nowadays. Even in system, in construction systems, let's say, not only in materials. So the question is, from your perspective, what are the main structural and cultural barriers that prevent alternative materials from being widely implemented?
Thank you, Pedro. Thank you for the introduction, the invitation, and it's great to be here joining the podcast. We start with like the question, right? Like a very complex question. And before jumping into the topic, I want just to clarify that I'm not an architect myself, and we do not work directly in the construction sector. So of course, my understanding and my answer will be partial, but I will try to answer anyway from the perspective of my position here at the Jan van Eyck and with the work we are doing with Future Materials, with all the insights that the contributors of the program are offering us. So just to give a bit of context also for the listeners, Future Materials is a program by the Jan van Eyck Academy that is an art residency located in the south of the Netherlands, in Maastricht, that hosts a cohort, a group of 36 different artists, architects, writers, curators, performers. So like in terms of disciplines, it's very varied. And what we do is supporting them in their research. Within this context, we initiated in 2020 the Future Materials Program that investigates sustainable alternatives to existing toxic materials that are mostly commonly used in the arts, but then, of course, their use and their application expands beyond the art field itself. So what we are doing is really looking at a niche of material research and harvesting and collecting material projects that have been experimented in different parts of the world with sustainable materials. And by sustainable, we refer to natural, we refer to circular, we refer to recyclable. So it's a mix also of practices like between ancient and the most innovative. So we go from natural dyeing to biopolymers that really use like bacteria in order to create composite from ceramic waste. I'm just like putting one there. So of course, like we work in the small scale of artistic practices in cultural institutions, but we like the program has reached an audience that allows us to have insights also in other sectors. So it's relatively often we receive visits from architects, and we have even like an architect studio here in the building, so very close to us, and we have like conversation very often. And I think actually the questions of transitions towards more sustainable practices, whether they are construction or artistic, I mean, the questions really cross the different, are really intersectoral. So what I can see here, or from my own position, is that something that sort of slowed down, because there is a change happening, but it's very slow, probably, especially for the urgencies of our times. It emerges also from a lack of knowledge about a lack of knowledge, a lack of awareness about the alternatives. So we know very well the unsustainable paradigm, the unsustainable practices with which we are working. It's very difficult to actually revive the knowledge that we lost about more sustainable ones.
Let me interrupt you just to understand. You have more or less 6 years of practice from now. You opened in 2020. Do you see any change on this 6 years? And I think the main question would be, are the persons aware that it's important to change materials?
I think people are increasingly aware, and there is a sort of like slow acceleration, if you bear with a paradoxical expression. So there's like a sort of accelerations. There is certainly like more funding, at least here in the Netherlands, available for sustainable research and sustainable applications in specifically with materials. Especially here in Maastricht, there is a lot of research being conducted on sustainable textiles, so on the textile sectors, for instance. People are aware of the problem, but sometimes they feel the problem is too big to tackle. So they don't know really how to start. And especially, I think, for people involved with the problem, so architects, people involved in the construction sector, but artists and cultural practitioners, sometimes they really don't know, you know, they know how to do things with the old system. They don't know how to start creating alternatively. They don't know so much about, you know, like the properties of the new materials. And what I call new materials, it's, you know, again, sometimes yes, it's very ancient.
Of course.
So it's about also like making this knowledge available. Sometimes there are bias about the economics, so mm-hmm. like the cost of these more sustainable alternatives. And sometimes because perhaps we are like the market makes available so many, you know, give us so many different options of toxic and sustainable and highly environmentally impactful materials, we do not realize immediately how in fact cost effective it is to work with more sustainable alternatives that are more respectful both of the human bodies working with them, mm-hmm. of environment and of the atmospheres that they create. So there might be like this perception that there's like a barrier, that it's like a very difficult transition. And this is why we need to actually to have more often conversations. We need to have workshops. We need to really bring people together in order to sort of to tackle the transition collectively.
You have a very interesting thing that is a future materials bank and kind of huge archive, if you want, of experimental, sustainable, more traditional, more innovative materials. And my question is, this kind of archives are important? Is it very important to that the person see this? And why, what was really the reason why you did that?
Yeah, so the Future Materials Bank is, as you mentioned, an online archive. At the moment, we have slightly more than 500 different materials developed by almost the same number of makers in different parts of the world. So this gives a bit of an idea of the scale. And mostly all these practices come from creative practitioners. The Future Materials Bank was launched in October 2020. So at first we started with, like, the Jan van Eyck opened a Future Materials Lab here at the Academy because we wanted to support the participants, as we call the artists in residence, to sort of revive the knowledges we were talking about before, to sort of questioning, like, with which materials am I working with? What are, like, the impact on my own body and on, like, the modern human bodies outside there, on the landscapes of the materials I'm using? Very often there is even, like, a contradiction. So we might tackle thematically climate change or ecology or the ecological emergency with synthetic polymers or with synthetic resin. So there's, like, this sort of paradox and contradictions there. So we created the Future Materials Lab to make this knowledge available, to sort of empower them as well. And we might, like, talk about how also these materials are empowering, are working towards resilience in communities. But then in 2020, the pandemic arrived. So there was, like, a need to shift. I mean, the need to continue this work, this very important work, but with the new conditions made available by the lockdown. So this is how the Future Materials Lab shifted online, and we created the Future Materials Bank, which, because of the pandemic, but also because of the relevance of the questions, gained very big momentum and grew a lot. Because, of course, then we were talking not anymore to the community of the Academy, in which we are, but to a global community of makers that are, like, conducting very relevant research, and they could spontaneously submit their materials. So we have a material policy on the bank, giving some sort of guidelines about what we consider sustainable. And makers from anywhere could apply their materials. In this way, we are creating a body of knowledge that is available, because the bank is based on the, like, sort of the cultural commons, the knowledge commons principles. So it's open, available. There are, like, recipes, there are descriptions, there are the contacts of the makers, and anyone, whether it's a constructor, an architect, an artist, a curator, can access this body of knowledge and reach out to the maker and develop projects together, or just reach out with questions and build upon each other. Because this is also, like, one of the big questions that we are trying to tackle, is not to sort of work individually on reviving techniques and materials, but really how can we learn from each other. So if you're working with mycelium, how can I, rather than starting experimenting with mycelium from the same level where you started, how can I build up upon the knowledge that you already developed?
That's fundamental. But do you think there is a kind of impact of these new materials? So can you feel or can you give some examples where these biomaterials are already being used, that you can see that there are some change, or in construction, or even with artists? And if it's really true, or if it's really, or if you really think that this change will happen, or how important it is, this change of materiality?
Yeah, I think there are different scales. The difference in scale is very important. We definitely, from our position here, we see change happening in the small scale of individuals. So, for instance, in the artists that are gravitating here in the Academy, we have an increasing number of them willing to work with us. And very often they are already knowledgeable. They are coming here with their own techniques that they wanted to experiment further or to develop further. Some others are just, like, interesting to learn. So we do see, like, an urge. We do see, like, the question. What we also see is how institutional practice, so how the bigger scale, is difficult or have difficulties in embracing this challenge because of time, because of, as I mentioned before, like, economies. So in relation to time, what I mean is really, like, having very tight, accelerated timelines for projects, whether it is, like, a building, a construction, or whether it is an exhibition. We need work towards this neoliberal linear way of working, which there is a project which needs to be delivered in a certain amount of work, because this is like the requirements either from the customer or from the funding agency or from, you know, like visitors numbers and funding bodies. So of course, start working with initiating working with new materials requires a time for experimentation, requires a time in which you get to learn these materials. And this, I think, it's again cross-sectoral. It's not only in the arts. So it requires like this sort of learning process. But then I think once you work locally, once you develop like a practice in which you can reuse the materials or you can remold the materials, I think the benefits are manifold. It's difficult to say. I think a change is happening. And I think also like the geopolitical situations are telling us so loudly that we need to shift our practices, but it's still slow and it's still fraught and it's still very patchy.
Sure. It's in your experience, well, because we have been, especially in the residence, we have been talking a lot about that there is a kind of cultural resistance, let's say. Even if the persons are somehow aware, even if the persons are somehow talking about it, even if the persons somehow, they might don't have fully knowledge about things, but they understand that there is this need. But is some kind of break, cultural break. Do you agree with this or do you have another
100%. 100%. I do agree with this. It's not universal, luckily. There are exceptions. But for instance, I can bring examples from two contributors of the Future Materials Bank. One is Human Material Loop. So it's a startup developing textile fibers and yarns departing from discarded hair, human hair. Mm-hmm. So it's an amazing, like in terms of properties, is an amazing material, but they are struggling to find partners in order to make the yarn. So they can collect the material, they tested it in a very small scale. Now they would like to scale up. And in the Netherlands and in the surrounding countries, they couldn't find anyone. They found a yarning factory in Spain. So again, like you're trying to work sustainably, but then you have really like to ship your materials very far away in order just to experiment the next step. So, and why there's like such a reluctance? And the reluctance is because who owns the infrastructures is scared that the new material will create issues, that there will be like breakdowns, that there will be failures. Again, the other examples is from our previous Future Material Fellows. So these are researchers, artists coming here, spending 1 year here at the Academy and developing their project. And Polina was developing, I mean, has been developing glass making, like a glass making technique in which the glass has been developed with algae. So with silica derived from algae instead of extracted from seashore. It was extremely difficult. And she's now currently back in Paris. She cannot find the glass making facilities willing to give her the chance to experiment with her materials. We eventually, after much research, we could find someone here, but it was like it required a lot of research and a lot of talk. And now that she's not supported at the moment, she doesn't have the academy supporting her anymore, so she doesn't have this institutional backup. As a single practitioner, she's like struggling even more. So again, why is that? There's like a sort of resistance. There's like, we do perceive on the one hand the need of shifting, but on the other hand, we're also scared. About
it's only scared, it's also money involved. Because sometimes it's about money, but I don't really think it's about money, but I was just want to confirm with you.
I think it is about economy as well and money. I mean, again, we have already like practices and pathways of working that are well tested and they are made like as cost efficient as possible throughout decades of practice. And we are entering into a new field in which we need like to sort of develop new way of working and a new approach as well. And I'm convinced, and there are proofs that actually working locally can can be very cost efficient in the long term, especially also because of the properties that many of these materials have. But it requires some patience. So this sort of, like, to borrow from the economic and management vocabulary, like, the return on investment might be, well, first of all, might be not exclusively monetary, but it could be like much broader, like it might involve like environmental and social returns, but it's also spread in time. But in order to tackle the challenge, we should go beyond the short-term perspective. And this is key. This is crucial.
So you said it there a bit, but I would like that you develop a bit, because I believe that these future materials, it's not only about environmental change. It's also, of course, but I think it's also fundamental because it's also social. And there is a very important social thing as a society, but also as individuals working. And you spoke a bit about that there, because especially architects, engineering, when then we pick materials, we really don't think about the complexity that is around materials. Okay, so we just think, well, this is, what's the guarantee, what's the certificate, how much time it will last, whatever. And I think it's much more complex than that.
It is indeed. And this is also what ecological thinking and climate change is inviting us to think, like, in which terms, right? Like, to think rather than sort of in isolated boxes or in isolated silos, but think more systemically about how things work, how, like, a specific decision has impact in different dimensions. So yes, we find very important to consider the social dimensions of sustainability, of ecology, and these have many different meanings. So this means to consider how labor is remunerated, how are the labor conditions throughout the supply chain of a specific materials, but also how, when we are talking, for instance, about sustainable materials, very often we go back to traditional techniques. How do we protect the source of these traditional techniques? How we make sure that communities are protected and that we prevent to extract knowledge from these communities as we have done, like, in the past, but we try to benefit back the communities, or even more, how to create a symbiotic relationship in which we could benefit from their knowledges and benefit them back in terms of protecting these knowledges towards the future. So it's important to think how environment is also very much connected to social environments. It's very much important to think, again, systemically about who's very often also the impact of our choices or our materials is delocalized. So is happening very far away. So actually being aware about the supply chain, being aware about what it happens to both ecosystems and social ecosystems far away is also very important to not to make a sort of linear change in which we, for instance, substitute plastic with bioplastics, but we really think how to change the paradigm. And I will bring an example for this, which is, for instance, algae. Algae and agar agar is, like, increasingly used or seen as a very promising material, especially in relation to bioplastics, but it goes beyond. Well, one of the countries that is, like, the main exporter of agar agar is Morocco, and they do realize how, in fact, like, an extensive exploitation of marine ecosystems in order to respond to the increasing and the growing demand of agar agar is threatening the ecosystem itself. So it is threatening the source of these materials. So in fact, from a purely market perspective, they issued, like, the Moroccan government issued some laws in order to protect the specific ecosystem where agar agar work. So I want to stress that it doesn't come from, like, an ecological and environmental sustainable principles, but it's still, like, they are very, very much aware about the systemic impact that, like, a specific supply might have. And at the same time, it's also, like, how the benefit of, for instance, the industry behind agar agar are benefiting the communities of harvesters that are involved in the process of making agar-agar available. So how are like the economic benefits distributed within a community? So there are like all these questions. So we go from like traditional knowledges from indigenous community or non-indigenous to also like the social dimensions of how to remunerate the community involved in a specific industry, whether this is sustainable materials or not. These are all very relevant questions that we need like to consider all the time when we think about sustainability.
Is there any material that you would, do you think that it's there is a future for that material that no one is seeing? So I know it's a kind of not only difficult question but a kind of stupid question, but it's just a kind of curiosity. If you really, really think that, for example, working with this or that, it would be make much more sense in a certain point, or you think that there is, it's more complex and you cannot point one or two or five materials that could change something very fast.
Again, I think, is it really about fast change, what we
that's,
want?
That's also the other question.
That's also the question.
No, I think actually it is about fast, because we are in a kind of urgency, right? So the fastness of changing, everybody tells us all the days that we need to change very fast, but actually it's not happening. It's very, very slow. So that's a question. Can we... Yeah. We can change slow? Is that possible?
I mean, I was thinking about this. It's perhaps like, it's not really like, you know, either to choose between slow or fast, but perhaps how can we have different speeds, different pace, different rhythms in addressing this change? I was thinking about this right yesterday. I was talking with Studio Sufi, like a local startup working with natural dyes and local wood threads. Another of these examples of a practitioner's a studio working with sustainable materials locally, who has to go to Italy, to another like country quite far away. So we're like in the Netherlands here, relatively far away, to spin the fibers into a yarn, because they cannot find here in the region anyone who can do it. And I was like talking with her and asking like, how is this possible? And she was like, well, here in the Netherlands we don't have any more like the skills and the knowledge to do these practices. So and I can see how here I'm from Italy, so I see like sort of also I have this cultural distance. I'm based here since 2021, but still I can see the differences. I can see also like how the accelerated pace and this sort of urge to change is also like making, you know, sort of erasing the past, erasing something in this very accelerated process. And perhaps if we could maintain different temporalities, different time pace, we could sort of have also like a more diverse ecosystem of knowledges and ecosystem of practices. So we could have like the very innovative industries, the very innovative practices and innovation, but we could have also like sort of something that proceeds much slower and perhaps even seems stuck in the past. But perhaps it is important to maintain it there as well. So in that sense, I'm not sure whether it's only about being fast. I think it's also about, we were talking before about the social consequences, but also how can we pay attention and consider and account for the change and for the impact that our change and our innovation have. Very often this impact is not visible, is not as, we cannot assess it right away. We need actually to wait for a few years, sometimes even decades. So before like implementing change in a very fast way, we need also to sort of slow down to see the impact and the consequences that the change we realize have in our surroundings. And to go back to your question about like if I have in mind like a sustainable or a particularly promising materials, I think it depends very much on the locality in which you are. So there's not like a universal promising materials. As I mentioned before, algae are definitely like among the most researched materials at the moment, also because of how they are capable of absorbing carbon, absorbing toxicities from the ecosystems, heavy metals, and so on. And at the same time, also like it can be used in bio-based material practices. But it depends very much because, again, if you are like in a country that doesn't have access, or you know, that have very limited access to water bodies, and thus algae, probably this is not like the most advisable pathway to research. So I think really like starting from looking at a locality, looking at what's available in the surrounding, and perhaps also doing research about small practices, small studios, traditional crafts that are there, that are surviving, and how we can bind alliances with these practices in order to perhaps implement them in a bigger scale. I think this is like, it's not really a material, but it's a promising methodology.
Yes, it's very interesting what you were saying, because it's kind of the opposite of that normally special politicians and also all the sound bits that we listen very often about these silver bullets. So everybody's looking for one shot, one silver bullet, one solution, one simplified thing. And you say, no, it's very complex. We need to use different base, kind of palinsesto of different cultures, times, and persons that actually we are doing at the moment. So it's very interesting moment what you're saying and what you are describing. But just to finalize, my last question would be a bit again about this future. And I know that you already somehow describe a complex future, that it's very interesting, and maybe it's more a present than the future. But I would like that you would go a bit like 2100 or 2150, whatever. So a future. So we are, I understand that we are in a transition, and what you describe is super interesting, and I think we should really go on this direction. But if you somehow can push yourself to on a future travel on time, what would you like to see more than what you would see? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's I'll try not to be dystopic in this question.
Really not.
Of course. I think what I would like to see in 100 years is probably I would like to see a world in which like the word waste as we consider it doesn't exist anymore. So the concept of waste will be something from the past. You know, like that even, I mean, among the different materials that we have on the Future Materials Bank, there are the human body materials, human animal materials. So I already mentioned human hairs, but we have also like some materials using urine from the human body, using tears. How can we sort of look around us and think creatively and imagine how all the materialities we have surrounding us can be employed to benefit, to create things, to create different materials? How can we sort of shift the perspectives between what can be exploited and what cannot? So why are we using animal hairs like wool, for instance, and we're not using our own hairs, right? Why aren't we considering our bodies? And I'm aware here that some bodies have been exploited for like centuries. So how aren't we considering also like our own body, like as a producer of materials that we can harvest and we can share and we can make available? And I think especially also like a shift in terms of what we consider like regeneration. So it's like circularity, but on the next perspective, how can we think about how materials, not only how bodies, whether they are humans, vegetal or animals, can be used to obtain materials, but also how each act of obtaining is also like entails a reciprocity of giving back. So it, I'm shifting from materials, but to methodology, because I think this is super important. So how can we embed really reciprocities in all our actions?
Because materials are the result of the mythologies. So the materials are totally the result of societies, our needs, our social interaction, etc., etc.
So how can we embed really in our thinking feedback loops?
Sure.
You know, like thinking circularly about impacts and about how things can like flow back into the environment. You know, like after for some reasons we discard them. So whether they are like constructions or whether they are artworks.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to speak with you. I really loved your ideas, and I hope you are doing amazing work. It's a pleasure to speak with you, and congratulations for all the work that you have been doing. Hopefully, I hope you come and see our installation in cardboard here in the CAM in Lisbon, in the Gulbenkian.
Thank you, Pedro. That would be fantastic. I would love that.
Thank you very much and see you soon, hopefully.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Radio at the Camera. Listening to architecture, imagining other ways of inhabiting.